Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English.
Today on the program, Brian Lynn will bring us this week's technology report. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, many Americans are expressing shock at the Trump administration's policy of separating children from their parents at the United States border with Mexico. But throughout U.S. history, officials have taken such action. Here are some examples. Slave families were often separated in sale. Slave owners could sell slave children to anyone. Their parents had no legal rights to prevent their sale and could do little to stop them. Some slave families attempted to escape, but all faced severe punishment, even death, if captured. U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions used the Christian holy book, the Bible, to defend the policy of forced separation. He said, "I would cite you to the Apostle Paul and his clear and wise command in Romans 13 to obey the laws of the government because God has ordained them for the purpose of order." That same passage was cited before the Civil War as a defense for separating slave children from their mothers.
In the 1870s, the United States began a policy of forcible assimilation for Native Americans. The government ordered the removal of Native American children from their families and reservations. They were sent to boarding schools that many described as similar to prisons. The schools were established with the goal of destroying all Indian tradition and nature within the child. At about 150 Indian schools around the country, officials made Native American children cut their traditional long hair and banned them from speaking in their native language. The schools forced the children to accept Christianity and white customs. Native American children returned home almost unrecognizable to their parents. Still, some children resisted by setting fires to buildings, running away, or taking their own lives. Others continued to speak their native language in secret. Some Navajo code talkers were students at the boarding schools as children. During World War II, they used a code based on their native language to send secret messages for the U.S. military. Indian boarding school policies remained in place through the 1960s.
During the early 1900s, American states sometimes took children from poor families and placed them in orphanages. Author Michael Katz wrote in his book, In the Shadow of the Poorhouse, A Social History of Welfare in America, that this practice ended in the 1920s and 1930s. However, Katz said, local and state officials continued to use poverty as a reason to take children away from Native American and African American families. Sometimes the ordered separation came over concerns about a parent's mental health. The late civil rights activist Malcolm X described his experience of such treatment in a book about his life. He wrote that government workers took him and his siblings from his mother after the murder of their father. He said he lived in several foster homes and boarding houses. He said his mother, without her children, had a psychological breakdown and was ordered to a mental health asylum.
During the Great Depression, California and Texas officials blamed Mexican immigrants and Mexican Americans for the economic event. They forced between 500,000 and 1 million Mexicans and Mexican Americans to leave the United States. Francisco Valderrama co-wrote Decade of Betrayal, Mexican Repatriation in the 1930s. He said some families hid children with family members in the U.S. to prevent them from being sent from the country. Many families felt they were being forced to separate from their children, who were U.S. citizens. And many children, Valderrama said, never saw their parents again.
Former U.S. First Lady Laura Bush criticized the current family separation policy in an opinion piece published by the Washington Post newspaper. She compared the images of children in tent cities in the desert outside El Paso, Texas, to those in internment camps for U.S. citizens and non-citizens of Japanese descent during World War II. In 1942, shortly after the bombing of Pearl Harbor by Japanese forces, President Franklin Roosevelt signed an order forcing around 120,000 people of Japanese ancestry into internment camps around the country, including 30,000 children. George Takei is an American actor who was sent to an internment camp at the age of 5. Takei wrote in Foreign Policy, "At least during the internment of Japanese Americans, I and other children were not stripped from our parents. We were not pulled screaming from our mother's arms. We were not left to change the diapers of younger children by ourselves."
Computers are increasingly competing against humans to see whether man or machine is smarter. In the latest demonstration of artificial intelligence, or AI, a computer went up against humans in live public debates. The debates, held this week in San Francisco, provided a new example of how computers are fast improving to think and sound more like humans. The event was a demonstration of an AI system developed by major technology company IBM. It is called Project Debater. IBM said it was the first time ever that an AI system has competed in a live public debate with humans. Two separate debates were held between a computer and two human debaters. The company pre-selected possible subjects for discussion, but said neither the computer nor the humans knew the chosen subject before the debate. The discussions were set up in a similar way to most political debates. After preparing arguments, both sides got the chance to present a 4-minute opening statement. Then came 4-minute rebuttals, followed by closing statements. In one debate, IBM's computer battled Noah Ovadia, a former national debate champion for Israel. The debate was based on the following statement: "We should subsidize space exploration." The AI system made a case in favor of government-subsidized space research. The computer was represented at the event as a tall and thin black box with a small screen in front that changed designs when speaking and listening. It spoke in a female voice.
"Thank you for the opportunity to be here today."
The AI system pulled in evidence from its huge supply of information from newspapers, journals, and other sources. Ovadia took the opposite position, arguing that the government could better serve the people by providing financial assistance for programs other than space exploration.
"You are speaking at the extremely fast rate of 218 words per minute. There is no need to hurry."
Project Debater then launched its rebuttal speech. It argued that government spending on space would be a very sound investment because it would be great for the economy, technology, and society as a whole. The rebuttal ended with the machine stating that subsidizing space exploration is like investing in really good tires. The AI system explained its reasoning. "While no one really wants to spend money on tires, people decide to do so in the end because it is the best and safest decision." Following closing statements from both sides, reporters and other attendees gave their opinions on the results. IBM reported that a majority of those who watched the debate said they believed Project Debater had improved their knowledge of the subject more than the human debater. On the other hand, the human debater got praise for better communicating her ideas. IBM's Vice President of AI Research, Dario Gil, told the Associated Press this was not that surprising. He said humans are generally better at using more expressive language, more original language. Ovadia said her AI opponent showed surprising language ability in constructing sentences. She added that the computer was not only able to get to the bottom of her arguments, but also able to intelligently answer them.
Thank you for listening.
Among several outside experts invited to attend was Chris Reed. He directs the Center for Argument Technology at the University of Dundee in Scotland. Reed said the computer effectively used a debating method that predicts an opponent's argument and rebuts it before it is brought up. The event included a second debate about whether technology should be used to help doctors treat patients living far away across the world. An IBM research team based in Israel has been working on Project Debater for 6 years. It was launched after IBM's Watson computer system beat two humans competing on the knowledge game show Jeopardy in 2011. But IBM officials say Project Debater goes beyond its Watson technology to explore new AI territory. It is designed not only to process large amounts of data in an effort to outsmart an opponent, it can also help people create persuasive arguments and make well-informed decisions. The company says Project Debater's methods will eventually be offered in its IBM Cloud and IBM Watson businesses. The debate came about a month after Google demonstrated how its AI system was able to make a haircut appointment in a very human-like way. Earlier in the year, AI machines outperformed humans in a high-level reading test. I'm Brian Lynn.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. I'm Barbara Klein.
And I'm Steve Ember. The stock market crash of 1929 marked the beginning of the worst economic crisis in American history. Millions of people lost their jobs. Thousands lost their homes. During the next several years, a large part of the richest nation on earth learned what it meant to be poor. Workers lost their jobs as factories closed. Business owners lost their stores and sometimes their homes. Farmers lost their land as they struggled with falling prices and natural disasters. And Americans were not the only ones who suffered.
One of America's greatest writers, John Steinbeck, described the Depression this way: "It was a terrible, troubled time. I can't think of any 10 years in history when so much happened in so many directions. Violent change took place. Our country was shaped. Our lives changed. Our government rebuilt." Steinbeck, winner of the 1962 Nobel Prize in Literature, said, "When the market fell, the factories, mines, and steelworks closed, and then no one could buy anything, not even food."
An unemployed auto worker in Detroit, Michigan, described the situation this way: "Before daylight, we were on the way to the Chevrolet factory to look for work. The police were already there, waving us away from the office. They were saying, 'Nothing doing, no jobs, no jobs.' So now we were walking slowly through the falling snow to the employment office for the Dodge Auto Company. A big, well-fed man in a heavy overcoat stood at the door. 'No, no,' he said, 'there was no work.'" One Texas farmer lost his farm and moved his family to California to look for work. "We can't send the children to school," he said, "because they have no clothes."
"Sunday is gloomy. My hours are slumberless. Dearest, the shadow. Of sorrow has taken you.
The economic crisis began with the stock market crash in October 1929. For the first year, the economy fell very slowly, but it dropped sharply in 1931 and 1932. And by the end of 1932, the economy collapsed almost completely. During the 3 years following the stock market crash, the value of goods and services produced in America fell by almost half. The wealth of the average American dropped to a level lower than it had been 25 years earlier. All the gains of the 1920s were washed away. Unemployment rose sharply. The number of workers looking for a job jumped from 3% to more than 25% in just 4 years. One of every three or four workers was looking for a job in 1932.
Those employment numbers did not include farmers. The men and women who grew the nation's food suffered terribly during the Great Depression. This was especially true in two states, Oklahoma and Texas. Farmers there were losing money because of falling prices for their crops. Then natural disasters struck. Year after year, little or no rain fell. The ground dried up, and then the wind blew away the earth in huge clouds of dust. All that dust made some of the farmers leave, one Oklahoma farmer remembered later. But my family stayed. We fought to live. Despite all the dust and the wind, we were planting seeds. But we got no crops. We had five crop failures in 5 years.
Falling production, rising unemployment, men begging in the streets. But there was more to the Great Depression. At that time, the federal government did not guarantee the money that people put in banks. When people could not repay loans, banks began to close. In 1929, 659 banks with total holdings of $200 million went out of business. The next year, two times that number failed. And the year after that, almost twice that number of banks went out of business. Millions of people lost all their savings. They had no money left.
The Depression caused serious public health problems. Hospitals across the country were filled with sick people whose main illness was a lack of food. The health department in New York City found that one of every five of the city's children did not get enough food. 99% of the children attending a school in a coal mining area of the country reportedly were underweight. In some places, people died of hunger. The quality of housing also fell. Families were forced to crowd into small houses or apartments to share costs. Many people had no homes at all. They slept on public streets, buses, or trains. One official in Chicago reported in 1931 that several hundred women without homes were sleeping in city parks. In a number of cities, people without homes built their houses from whatever materials they could find. They used empty boxes or pieces of metal to build shelters in open areas.
People called these areas of little temporary houses Hoovervilles. They blamed President Hoover for their situation. So too did the men forced to sleep in public parks at night. They covered themselves with pieces of paper, and they called the paper Hoover blankets. People without money in their pants called their empty pockets Hoover flags. People blamed President Hoover because they thought he was not doing enough to help them. Hoover did take several actions to try to improve the economy, but he resisted proposals for the federal government to provide aid in a major way, and he refused to let the government spend more money than it earned. Hoover told the nation, "Economic depression cannot be cured by legislative action or executive decision." Many conservative Americans agreed with him, but not the millions of Americans who were hungry and tired of looking for a job. They accused Hoover of not caring about common citizens. One congressman from Alabama said, "In the White House, we have a man more interested in the money of the rich than in the stomachs of the poor."
On and on, the Great Depression continued. Of course, some Americans were lucky. They kept their jobs, and they had enough money to enjoy the lower prices of most goods. Many people shared their earnings with friends in need. Years later, John Steinbeck wrote, "It seems odd now to say that we rarely had a job. There just weren't any jobs." But he continued, "Given the sea and the gardens, we did pretty well with a minimum of theft. We didn't have to steal much." Farmers could not sell their crops, he explained, so they gave away all the fruit and vegetables that people could carry home.
Other Americans reacted to the crisis by leading protests against the economic policies of the Hoover administration. In 1932, a large group of former soldiers gathered in Washington to demand help. More than 8,000 of them built the nation's largest Hoovervilles near the White House. Federal troops finally removed them by force and burned their shelters.
Once I built a railroad, made it run, made it race against time. Once I built a railroad, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime? Once I built a tower to the sun, brick and rivet and lime. Once I built a tower, now it's done. Brother, can you spare a dime?
Next week, we will look at how the Great Depression of the 1930s affected other countries.
Went slogging through hell, and I was the kid with a drum.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.